1790, Mug in 1708, and Kisser in the mid-18th century. Harby's 17th-century hospital was beside the shambles of Smithfield, and that conjunction may suggest another image of the city. It is fleshy and voracious, grown fat upon its appetite for people and for food, for goods and for drink. It consumes and it excretes, maintained within a continual state of greed and desire. For Daniel Defoe, London was a great body which circulates all, exports all, and at last pays for all. That is why it has commonly been portrayed in monstrous form, a swollen and dropsical giant which kills more than it breeds. Its head is too large, out of proportion to the other members. Its face and hands have also grown monstrous, irregular, and out of all shape. It is a spleen, or a great wen. A body racked with fever and choked by ashes, it proceeds from plague to fire. Whether we consider London as a young man refreshed and risen from sleep, therefore, or whether we lament its condition as a deformed giant, we must regard it as a human shape with its own laws of life and growth. Here, then, is its biography. If you were to touch the plinth upon which the equestrian statue of King Charles I is placed at Charing Cross, your fingers might rest upon the projecting fossils of sea lilies, starfish, or sea urchin. There's a photograph of that statue taken in 1839. With its images of hackney cabs and small boys in stovepipe hats, the scene already seems remote. Yet how unimaginably distant lies the life of those tiny marine creatures. In the beginning was the sea. There was once a music hall song entitled, "Why Can't We Have the Sea in London?" But the question is redundant. The site of the capital, 50 million years before, was covered by great waters. The waters have not wholly departed, even yet, and there is evidence of their life in the weathered stones of London. The Portland stone of the Customs House and St. Pancras Old Church has a diagonal bedding which reflects the currents of the ocean. There are ancient oyster shells within the texture of Mansion House and the British Museum. Seaweed can still be seen in the greyish marble of Waterloo Station, and the force of hurricanes may be detected in the chatter-marked stone of pedestrian subways. In the fabric of Waterloo Bridge, the bed of the Upper Jurassic Sea can also be observed. The tides and storms are still all around us, therefore. And as Shelley wrote of London, "That great sea still howls on for more." London has always been a vast ocean in which survival is not certain. The dome of St. Paul's has been seen trembling upon a vague, troubled sea of fog, while dark streams of people flow over London Bridge or Waterloo Bridge and emerge as torrents in the narrow thoroughfares of London. The social workers of the mid-19th century spoke of rescuing drowning people in Whitechapel or Shoreditch, and Arthur Morrison, a novelist of the same period, invokes a howling sea of human wreckage crying out to be saved. Henry Peacham, the 17th-century author of The Art of Living in London, considered the city as a vast sea, full of gusts, fearful, dangerous shelves and rocks, while in 1810 Louis Simond was content to listen to the roar of its waves breaking around us in measured time. If you look from the distance, you observe a sea of roofs, and have no more knowledge of the dark streams of people than of the denizens of some unknown ocean. But the city is always a heaving and restless place, with its own torrents and billows, its foam and sprays. The sound of its streets is like the murmur from a seashell, and in the great fogs of the past, the citizens believed themselves to be lying on the floor of the ocean. Even amid all the lights, it may simply be what George Orwell described as the ocean bottom among the luminous, gliding fishes. This is a constant vision of the London world, particularly in the novels of the 20th century, where feelings of hopelessness and despondency turn the city into a place of silence and mysterious depths. Yet like the sea and the gallows, London refuses nobody. Those who venture upon its currents look for prosperity or fame, even if they often founder in its depths. Jonathan Swift depicted the jobbers of the exchange as traders waiting for shipwrecks in order to strip the dead, while the commercial houses of the city often used a ship or boat as a weather vane and as a sign of good fortune.